All right. Okay, good morning, everyone. So I will talk about following up this talk about Laurent about the morphology of crack. I will start by some consideration about the morphology, but I hope I will have time to talk about avalanche dynamic. And okay, this work has been done essentially in the group of Knut-Jürgen Molloy when I used to be a postdoc quite some time ago. And collaborating with Renaud Toussaint. Also, I was co-supervising the Kent Ruud Alagstad as a PhD student. Now he went on to get some money in private business, unfortunately. And also, more recently, I started to collaborate with Lasse Olofsson and Mikko Alava in Helsinki. And as you will see, there has been also a lot of other colleagues involved. So I will discuss essentially an experiment. And it's this one, which has been originally designed by Jean Schmidbuhl and Knut-Jürgen Molloy a long time ago in Oslo. And this is a very beautiful, ingenious, elegant experiment. The idea was simply to simplify this problem that Laurent, for instance, has been discussing, where you're breaking a piece of rock or whatever. I mean, when you have a crack growing in such a sample, you have both an out-of-plane and an in-plane roughness. So in order to simplify this geometry, Jean and Knut-Jürgen decided to propose the following setup in order to constrain the crack to propagate within an interface. So the idea was simply to test a model that was developed by the same people and also Stéphane Roux, who was supposed to discuss this morning such models. Unfortunately, he's not around. And this numerical approach was originally developed or proposed by, it was an idea by Bouchot and collaborators quite some time ago. The idea was the following. It was just the crack surfaces could be seen as just the footprint of the crack front propagating in a disordered landscape, just the footprint of the crack front being an elastic line. The novelty, though, in the approach developed by those guys, was that they used the long-range elastic kernel of Gao and Rice, and therefore the force on the line was non-local, and that triggered many new things. So of course, well, they were considering quasi-static growth, a linear elastic material, and some weak heterogeneities. All right. And of course, I mean, this type of approach is not only concerned many different type of system, not only cracks, but also contact line or magnetic domain walls. And you have many specialists in the room here. So the problem, that experimentally, all the interfacial roughness exponent has been measured until quite recently to be about 0.5 or 0.6, while the theoretical predictions or the numerical results were about 0.35, 0.38. So this has triggered a huge discussion, a long-standing controversy within the last 10 years. And in particular, it has triggered the development of some new models, like what Laurent is calling damage coalescence or percolation-like models. And this essentially developed by Alex Hansen. I don't know if he's supposed to be around, but I haven't seen him. Well, so the point is that there has been a lot of debate in the community. And the goal of my talk and the goal actually of my work in the last years has been to clarify this apparent disagreement and controversy. And what I will do first, I will discuss the morphology of those interfacial cracks, and I will go on the avalanche dynamic. So let's go to the experiment. Of course, I'm an experimentalist, so this is, again, it's a really beautiful and simple experiment. Basically, you take two plexiglass plates. You sandblast them in order to get the surfaces rough, and you lose the transparency. And you anneal them, you clamp them together, you put this in an oven, and you sinter them. So therefore, you get a transparent block with a weak interface containing heterogeneities. So you have toughness fluctuations due to the sandblasting procedure. And therefore, when you will open up this block, of course, you will get a rough crack front and a burst-like dynamic, as you will see. So one point, I mean, it's a really nice and beautiful experiment. However, this sintering process and the sandblasting, you don't control perfectly the size of the disorder, the strength of the disorder, and this is a problem. And well, there are some attempts recently to try to improve this aspect, and I hopefully will manage now. Anyway, so the optical and mechanical setup is the following. I mean, the upper plate is clamped, and a mechanical press imposes a normal displacement. And we have performed many different experiments in many different conditions, creep or constant low speed. You force the bottom plate. And as a result, the crack is propagating in a quasi-mode 1 along this weak interface. So to track the propagation, actually we are using high-speed and high-resolution camera. Depending on the conditions, if you have creep or you have a really slow crack growth, we are always using a camera, well, a frame rate, which is much larger than the average crack velocity in order to really capture the whole dynamic and especially the burst at the local scale of the disorder that we have introduced. Also, I won't discuss that, but we can put some microphones or piezoelectric transistor to track the acoustic emissions. And basically, we have played with average crack front velocities in a very wide range of scales, well, typically from this to this. And also, we have played on the resolution at which we are looking at the crack front. Okay, we will see later on the dynamic. But first, I will discuss in detail the morphology. So the idea is just to, again, to clarify this controversy I mentioned in the introduction. So in order to have a really high resolution description of the crack, so this is a typical image that I obtained. So after breaking my sample, what I did is that I've been assembling really high resolution pictures, but the crack is at rest. So I can assemble many different pictures at a really high resolution. And therefore, I can play on the resolution, the number of images I'm assembling, and I have a really wide range of pixels, you see? And this is, of course, I do that for many different fronts in many different conditions. So this is what I call a multi-high resolution description. And so here I present directly the statistical distribution of the height fluctuation at different scale delta. So again, I don't know. Typically, I'm looking at the front. It's really easy to extract the height, and I'm looking at this quantity, the fluctuation delta H, at different scale delta here. So let's go back. Since we have a lot of statistics, we can directly extract, here it's in the semi-log scale, the statistical distribution for different value delta. And what you observe is that at large scale, here, as we have heard before, you obtain a Gaussian statistic. But at really small scales, you see you have those large states. And the interesting point is that the distribution, the statistical distribution, they evolve through the scales when you increase delta until a characteristic scale at which you obtain the Gaussian, and then it's just the width which is evolving. Yeah, I'm rescaling by the standard deviation, this typical width. Okay. And what you see, I'm representing this the width of those statistical distribution and their scaling in log-log. And what you can see is that you have two different regimes, two different slopes, and therefore, if you want, it's what Laurent was calling, I mean, the slope corresponds to the roughness exponent. And what you observe, funnily, at small scale, you observe something close to 0.6, while at large scale, something close to 0.3, which corresponds exactly to the different type of exponent that people were arguing for 10 years. So, okay. Once again, so you have those two scaling regimes, and with one roughness at large scale, which is close to in agreement with the elastic line model, and at small scale, eventually, a roughness exponent that could be in agreement with percolation-like models. So let's go further on. In order to to analyze in more detail these scaling properties, we have performed what we call the multi-scaling analysis. And this has been done in collaboration with Alex Hansen. And typically, what we are looking at is what we call the structure functions. So here, we look at the increments in height at different scale, at the given order. While the difference with what people used to do in the literature, we take the root k here. And on top of that, we are renormalizing both the structure function by a set of numbers which correspond to Gaussian statistics. I will not go into detail, but you will understand now. And if you have some more questions, we can discuss it. So here, typically, it's the scaling of both structure function, renormalized by the Gaussian statistic, again, as a function of the scale. And so what we observe, as we observed previously, you have typically two different scaling regimes. At large scale, well, let's start by the small scale one. Here, what you observe is that, so here it's the structure function for the different orders, order 1, order 2, up to 5. And what we observe is the fanning of the structure functions here. So what does that mean? First, you have a non-Gaussian statistics underlying, and you have a non-unique roughness exponent. So what we say again, we have a multi-scaling. So the roughness exponent depends on the order, on the quantity what you computed to extract it. So okay, you can have, if you look at the order 2, which is usually what people use to extract what they call roughness exponent, okay, you get a 0.6. But you have the whole spectrum, actually, to describe the distribution and the statistical distribution of your height fluctuation, you need the full spectrum of those roughness exponents. So it was exactly my point when I was telling you. You agree with that? You cannot use one single exponent. So we shouldn't say in this regime there is a roughness exponent which is OK. So then, but you have a transition. Above this characteristic scale, which is about 35 micrometer here, you have another completely different behavior of those structure functions. All of them collapse on a single curve, and there is a scaling. So what does that mean? The fact that they collapse means that the underlying distribution is Gaussian. The statistic is Gaussian. It's just because of my renormalization. And secondly, there is a unique roughness exponent, which is 0.38, which corresponds to the prediction of the elastic line model. Well, so this, OK, we published that quite some time ago, by the way. Well, now the question is, what controls this characteristic scale? What is it, this scale delta star, from which you have a multi-scaling regime and a monoaffine regime? Well, basically, what I did is that all the results that I presented before was when I was sandblasting my plates, I was using glass bead about 50 micrometer. And here, what I did, I just increased the size of the glass bead. I tried to be as clean as possible. Of course, once again, the disorder and the typical size of the heterogeneities, I don't control them, because first there is a sandblasting procedure, and then there is a sintering. But anyway. And what you observe is that, OK, these are the different glass beads that I used. And this is the scaling of the standard deviation of the distribution of the height fluctuations. OK, so what you see is that, interestingly, the amplitude of the scaling is increasing when you increase the size of your glass bead. But what is more striking and what is much more interesting is that the range over which you see those different scaling is evolving. OK? And in particular, this character scale at which you observe the two different regimes depends on the size of the bead. So more or less, what I say is that, OK, this transition is controlled by the material heterogeneities. On top of that, OK, once again, I superimpose structure function and the scaling of the structure function. And you see, indeed, that, OK, you have at this small scale, where you have large roughness exponent, you have many different roughness exponents. I mean, you have this multi-scaling regime. Yes, tell me.
So if you have this with a single block without this process of sintering,
two pieces.
I didn't get the beginning.
So if you did the experiment with the original, with a single block, where somehow the crack develops and propagates, which end of the spectrum would you have?
You mean without sandblasting? Well, the problem is that to control, I mean, you will not have a crack propagating at the interface. So you cannot do that. I tried to play with that. Actually, I tried to do that by putting some, not sintering some places and so on. I mean, actually, sometimes it goes in the bulk.
Now, I'm asking in which end you think.
I don't believe in things. I just do experiment, and then I try to be as clean as possible. This is a model experiment. Then you can break whatever. I'm sorry. Well, this is more or less controlled experiment. I want to insist on that, and this has been the real difficulty because you can discuss a lot. You had arguments for 10 years about those roughness exponents. So, again, above the values of the roughness exponent, what is interesting is that what is controlling this size? Because I don't really, again, control the material heterogeneities that I introduce. But if you look at, indeed, the local slope of the front, indeed what you see is that this is a slope of 4.3. So actually, it separates the two regimes, where you have high local slopes and small local slopes. And indeed, it's what you can observe here, for instance. So this is a close-up of the experiment, and you see you have the heterogeneities here due to the sintering process, which probably was not working very well. And here, for instance, you have a steep slope here. And this introduces this effective multiscaling, this deviation to the monofine scaling that we have observed, and that is predicted by this elastic line model when you use the kernel of Garo and Rice, because this kernel assumes small deviations. And of course, I mean, it's not the case. We don't have. So this is really setting the limit of this approach. And this is just what I want to say. Then, OK, so you have deviation to monofine scaling. And this has been, of course, observed for many for my crack front or interfacial cracks, but also we published that for many different type of crack surfaces in granite or in paper. And also there is a paper with Eran Buschbinder and Itamar Prokacha some years back. But the same type of scaling or effective multiscaling, I would say, at small scales could be observed on fracture in papers. But the problem is that here, look at this. When you break a sheet of paper, how do you define properly a crack front? You have the fibers popping out and so on. And actually, all of this, I mean, you may have overhangs sometimes. And when you choose to define a single value crack front, then, I mean, this, by definition, will introduce those tip slopes, will introduce some this effective multiscaling. So that's why I want to say, watch out with this. And another point, we verified also if you don't have enough resolution to describe well your roughness, you may introduce also some deviation to scaling. And this we have been describing in detail in this paper. Well, OK, so this was the first part of the talk. And so what I wanted to say is that, indeed, to describe the morphology of those interfacial crack, the elastic line approach seems to work quite well. But you have to watch out when you go at the scale of the heterogeneities, simply, or the microstructure or the process zone, then probably, maybe, you will need another type of approach, damage coalescence or pair coalescence-like, or maybe the elastic line model, you have to modify it. The kernel that we have been using is not the right one, of course, by definition. So anyway, you have those two different scaling regimes. And that's it. So I will go on because I have a lot to say concerning the dynamic, and I think it's more interesting, and I prefer it actually. This was quite some. I mean, it's quite old. So, but if you have some questions, just on the morphology, before going on.
I have a question. What can we learn from this in terms of fracture energy and fracture toughness? at the global scale, at the scale of the all the sample. I mean, all these different scaling regimes, the scale of transition between the different regime and so on.
I don't know.
Because it's, this should be the final
goal. Yeah, no, for
goal.
Sure.
I mean,
for sure, for okay. sure. I completely agree with you. The point is that what I wanted to say, then, I mean, first, the idea was to point out what is the right approach to describe the morphology and eventually the dynamic, as we will see. And there was big arguing in the literature, what is the approach, which model should we use, which is the right model to describe this. And for many years, people thought that this elastic line approach was completely wrong, it was completely off. And the point is that it's not. Well, now it's quite some time that we know that it works. So because, of course, I started to work on that. It's, I published that in 2006, 7, 10. Well, it's quite some time now. But OK, now the next step is what you're saying. But well, the point also is that there is one thing also experimentally. This experiment is elegant, but still there is a problem with that, and it's what I said. You don't really control the size of the heterogeneities. I more or less did, but and also the strength of it. And this is the point. This is the next step, and I would like to I have some. I'm working in the lab now to prepare typical blocks with a weak interface, but with controlled heterogeneities, size, distribution, shape, and strength. Just to play on the toughness fluctuations, and there I will be able maybe to go towards the same. But I agree with you, Jérôme. I'm sorry.
Very nice talk, but I also have very, from my point of view, important question.
Yeah, yeah.
You specified different sizes of bits which
yes.
you use for sandblasting,
yeah.
and you assume that there is a direct relationship.
No, no, it's exactly my point,
okay,
is that
okay. Okay,
I don't control that at all.
One thing which is necessary to present is velocity of these bits, because it is a viscoplastic deformation, and size of heterogeneity will be a function of the size of the bits and their velocity. If you don't introduce and don't control velocity of bits, you may have a confusion.
I controlled the velocity when I was sandblasting, and I was trying to do as clean as possible. But of course, once again, this is the main problem of the experiment. I don't control this. But I tried to be as clean as possible, changing just the size of the bit. It was the easiest parameter to play with.
Present velocity of bits next time.
Well, this I don't care, honestly. But I agree with you completely. But this is not the goal, actually. But
yeah, it's an interesting presentation.
But I have another part which is more interesting, actually. We should go on. Yeah, thanks.
Is it possible that you apply this to polymer material? Can you apply this to metal material? In the metal material, if you look at the fracture surface, there are several types of fracture surface: transcranial fracture, intergranial fracture, cleavage fracture.
Yeah.
Can you take into account this kind of situation for the metals?
I'm sorry, what kind of materials did you?
Metals.
Metals, oh. Well, yeah, it could be, but.
His next talk.
Yes, thanks. Thanks a lot. But you have a question still? No? Ah, thank you. Okay, so first, before continuing, just as a teaser, this is a typical experiment. Well, so typically, this is my crack growing. So probably some of you have seen this movie for quite some time, actually. Well, okay, at large scale, you have a stable, slow crack growth, all right? So the conditions are up there. So typically, the average velocity is about 30 micrometer per second. The resolution is 3.5 micrometer. But actually, let's play it again. You see, because of those heterogeneities, locally you can have pinning, and subsequently depinning because of the toughness fluctuation that I introduced. And of course, your interface is rough, and the dynamic is complex, characterized by burst avalanches and very large velocity fluctuations. So I will go on and present how we characterized was a very large velocity fluctuation and this dynamic. So, okay, quickly, to extract the front is really easy. At this scale, we don't really see overhangs. We may have steep slopes, as I've seen, but we don't have overhangs. And so what we have been doing is that we have been computing the waiting time fluctuation during the crack propagation. Okay, and basically what we did just computing what we the so-called waiting time matrix and just adding all the fronts that we have been extracting. Okay. And typically the result is this following map. So this is a map of waiting time or local velocity in the main direction of propagation of the crack. And basically what you observe, it's simply what you have seen already in the movie. You have many here gray scale labels. So the dark parts here, the dark lines, correspond to very long waiting times. And here, I mean, this is the waiting time. You have 3 decades in waiting times. And this is widely distributed in space and in time. So this, once again, reveals our intermittent in a loose way. Sorry for those who are doing multiscaling or turbulence or whatever. But this is really a jerky burst-like dynamic. And this is what this map tells you. Okay, and we can extract typically, based on those extracting the local waiting time at each point, we can extract the local velocity of the front. This will be a velocity which is defined at the pixel size, okay, which we have varied. Okay, so first, here what I represent is the local velocity distribution at each point of the interface for many different experiments in many different conditions, either creep or forced, and at very different scale. The only point is that I'm rescaling by the average velocity what we have measured. But you see first, all those distributions are collapsing on the unique distribution. So, and typically, so the velocity that are larger than the average is what I call the deepening regime, and below it's what I call the pinning. And the interesting point is that we have this Paolo tail here. And here, this is the exponent characterizing this tail. And you will see lately in a few slides that this value of the exponent is really important, especially when you are looking at the average crack growth. Because if the average velocity is well-defined, the higher order moments, they are not well-defined at all. And this is, I mean, you're really influenced by this extreme statistic and by the fastest events, the fastest velocities. So, well, this is a really peculiar distribution. And okay, first I observed it quite some time ago, and I've observed for all our various experiments in many different conditions, it's extremely robust result. And yeah, it's for a very wide range of driving velocity. It's 300 micrometer per second, the slowest.
What would you expect if you would have dynamical effects? I mean, with inertia.
It could be actually. It could be. I have some experiment at the very end. Maybe I will mention that. Okay. This is a very good point, and it may affect some observables. And up to now, I mean, on all what I've been measuring, I didn't see any effect of the driving velocity. Only very recently on one given observable that I will comment at the very end. I will tell you.
These are the exact velocities, the instantaneous velocities.
Exactly.
Not averaged over it.
No, this is, and this is the important point. So let me go on. Now we can go and analyze what people call the crackling noise, but okay, you know very well here. And the interesting point is that this experiment is once again a model experiment because we have access to the local front velocities. Usually people in most of experimental systems, you don't have access to this information. And usually you measure a global quantity at a given scale, what we call the. And here it's what I represent here, for instance, is the average velocity for another experiment. And here, I mean, let me tell you that it's another representation of this map. Here, it's a spatiotemporal map. So here, you have the velocity along the interface, x, as a function of time. And so what you see is that, okay, here it's this typical average velocity, and you have this really jerky signal. And of course, I mean, if you look at those bursts, for instance, they are the results of many different clusters or avalanches that occur at the same time at different places along the front. So one has to watch out because also, I mean, in the literature, you can see people discussing the scaling exponent of those guys or, I mean, of those ones. These are different quantities, and you have to watch out what you're looking at. So here, thanks to our local measurement, we are able to define a global crackling noise. But of course, I mean, this global velocity is the average or the sum of those local velocity here at a given time. But of course, as we have seen before, the local velocity is distributed according to this Paolo tail, this very fat tail. And therefore, we expect at the global scale to have non-Gaussian statistics. And invoking the generalization of the central limit theorem, actually, we are able to describe and to predict the shape of this, or the distribution of the global velocity. Okay, it's a bit technical, and I won't enter into detail, but it's really nice, I mean, thanks to our measurement at the local scale, we are able to infer what kind of distribution you can observe at the very large scale. So you observe this Levy type of distribution, and an interesting property of this type of distribution, this is the same, just represented in log-log, and I shifted. These are for different window, different scale of measurements. And the interesting point is that the fat tail here, or with this exponent, survives the upscaling. Okay? Well, so how much time do I have? It's okay? Or? Okay, I will go on. Okay, let's go back to this local velocity field and the local velocity map that I presented earlier. Based on that, you can define local avalanches or pinning clusters. So basically by just cutting and thresholding this local map and choosing different thresholds. And here, those white zones correspond to zones clusters of local velocity that are larger than a given threshold, meaning it's what I call the avalanche or deepening burst. And you can do the same for the pinning clusters. And interestingly, here are the distribution of the size of those objects. And what you observe is that this, for many, again, many different conditions, many different experiments, varying the thresholds. So these are extremely robust. And here are the size distribution for the avalanche or the deepening clusters, as well as for the pinning clusters. And for those who are interested in the exponent that we extract, it's close to 1.5. I will not describe, because we have many other quantities that we can look at, the duration, the shape, the spatial extension. So I just show you the size, all right? But now I will just comment on this. I will go back to this elastic line model that I discussed originally in the introduction and in relation to the morphology. Now I will show you that this type of approach is able also to reproduce the dynamic that I have just shown. And basically, this has been done in collaboration with Daniel Bonamy and Laurent as well. This is quite some time back, again, 0.8. But well, so we just developed a numerical resolution of this very first model developed originally by Schmidt, Bull, Roux, and Mallory. But the new thing is that, first to remind you, there is a quasi-static limit. We are considering a linear elastic material, weak heterogeneities, and we are using the long-range elastic kernel of Guyon-Rice. Okay? So this is this long-range elastic kernel. Okay, and this is a noise term, whatever. And this is the force on the line. The novelty and what Daniel has pointed out is the fact that the force that you apply on the line in our specific geometry, we compute it specifically in our geometry. The interesting point is that this force is not constant. And it's just this animation that Daniel has done, which tells you that, I mean, you have a kind of retro or feedback process that tells you that you're always close to this critical point. As soon as the crack is start to propagate, the velocity increases, but this quantity increases, the average height of the front, and therefore the force is decreasing. So if you are in a quasi-static limit, of course, you always turn around and close to this critical point as a self-organized critical system. Anyway, so the interesting point, and this has been done first in collaboration with Daniel, and then later on in collaboration with Lasse Lawson and Stefano Zapperi also, based on exactly the same type of analysis that I presented you for the experiment, we did that on the numerical resolution of this problem. And this is just, I show you a waiting time map, here the clusters, and the color code gives you the duration. And what I'm showing you is that typically here is the size distribution of the clusters, both for numerical simulation and experiment. And you see that they perfectly collapse, and you have a characteristic exponent of 1.5, okay? So this was the first question by Stefano a long time ago, but a bit surprised, and other people were surprised because this exponent is a bit larger than the typical crackling noise exponent that you expect. And this is what I'm going to tell you. It's, once again, here we are looking at clusters, not the crackling noise signal. And that's why the exponent characterizing this, the size distribution of this cluster is different. Okay, I will go on. So finishing on the crackling noise. Okay, so I'm able to compute the crackling noise. And what we are able to is just to, what I call crackling noise, just both huge burst of the average velocity. And we can compute the duration, the size of those objects, and so on. Let me go fast. So here, for instance, is the size versus duration renormalized for many different experiments, really slow experiment. And what you see, you have the expected scaling between the size and their duration with an exponent which is close to 1.7, which is close to the prediction of the elastic line approach again. And finally, I will just conclude to show you that we have computed the average shape of those avalanches. And here it's what I represent. And I compare it to a prediction that we have proposed recently in a paper that got published last year. And typically what you get, you can extract this exponent again, relating the size versus duration avalanches. And you extract something which is close to 1.7, 1.8, which correspond to the prediction of this elastic line approach. And which is very different to the two extreme case, if you want, of a mean field approach or an infinite range model, if you change the range of interaction in your kernel, okay? And I will conclude there. I'm a bit tired. And if you want to read more, because I try to make a short story based on a very long history. And if you want to have a look at those papers, you can. And if not, ask me questions. Thanks.
Okay, just so everyone knows, we're trying to go for about 10 minutes. We're missing a talk, and so we're going to have a longer break.
Yeah. Could I ask you a question?
Sure. We'll be pleased.
The distribution of avalanche size, as you showed, is parallel with the exponent 1.5, and then exponential, as I understand.
You have an exponential cutoff indeed.
Taper. Yeah. Is it exponential? You showed it just for a moment.
Yeah, it's an exponential cutoff.
Yeah. What is the dependence of this moment where it start decay on properties of materials or whatever?
Well, properties of materials, I cannot tell because I cannot really control systematically change the properties of the material. But in the inset, Here, for instance, I was showing up.
Yeah,
where is it? No. Yeah, but here, so it's the same more or less. I show you how this cutoff evolves with, for instance, the clipping threshold that I was using. And also, I mean, you could change, I mean, different. Now I don't remember, but of course, I mean, this cutoff is evolving with the driving velocity and so on, actually.
It's set by the thickness of the
light. Well, if you tell me that, I haven't been performing experiments at different thicknesses. We are trying to do that, and it could be. Actually, it's one, I mean, we have tried this. Theoretically, yeah, sure. I mean, we expect that it depends on that. Actually, we are in a quasi-mode one, but maybe, I mean, one plate on all those experiments is thinner, indeed. And this is a really good point. This is the plan. Also, there is a PhD student these days working on that, trying to change systematically the size of this plate.
Well, there's a highly developed
theory
for this
phenomenon. Yeah, that's nice. That would be good, but I and just well, I'm sorry, I didn't really answer your question, but the point is that there was one comment and one question by Jérôme earlier. I mean, about the driving velocity. Actually, I mean, this is in really, I mean, for the slowest experiment that I've done. I mean, the shape of the avalanches. I observe that they are really robust, and it's what I represent here. But actually, I recently reanalyzed some old data where I had really fast average growth, and it seems that, I mean, the noise is really high on this experiment. I need to have much more statistic, that there is a dependency on the shape of the avalanches with the driving, and maybe there are some inertial effects or so. I don't know. Oh no! Still very much lower. Still lower. And I mean, when I say an effect of the shape of the avalanche, it's this we have seen a systematic asymmetry in that case. Well, I cannot tell if there is any asymmetry there. So only my colleagues numerically they could observe some effect.
I have a question about the clusters.
Yeah.
So the clusters you're talking about are connected parts that unpins at the same time.
So say it again, Vincent.
The clusters that you consider?
Yes.
Are connected parts of the line that unpins at the same time. Is that right?
Not at the same time.
No, that unpins in the same avalanche, where you put a threshold and you take connected parts.
Okay, you take the velocity map.
Yes.
Okay. You cut it at a given level, meaning that this white cluster here is a region which is surrounded by a black zone.
Yes.
Meaning that these white spots are the local velocity larger than a given velocity.
Yes. So my question is it relevant here to take special connectedness because there is long-range elasticity? So
there is long-range elasticity.
Yes, but when you do this, you kind of assume that the parts that are not connected don't interact, right?
I don't assume anything. It's just the way extract. But of course, I agree with you. There is an interesting thing. And I try to, not in this system, but for, you know, my imbibition experiment that I've been playing with. The idea is just, I see your point, trying to point out some eventual correlation between avalanches. And here I didn't check that, but okay, this is just a way, it's my definition of avalanches. It's a bit different to what other people are defining as avalanches. Here I'm just saying it's a spatial region that had been advancing much larger than the average velocity.
But I think his point would be in these avalanches, there may be disconnected things depending at the same time.
Yes, exactly. But what I've been showing.
But you don't include those together, even if the white regions came from the same time period.
No.
Separate.
But this is a very important point, and that's why, I mean, it's what I wanted to show this spatiotemporal map. Here, for instance, you could have one avalanche, but you have many. This is space, this is time. This global cracking noise, this global avalanche, is the result of many different clusters, local clusters, that occur at the same time but at different positions. And they are maybe correlated or maybe not. And this is the point.
All right. So, Stefan, can you go back to your movie where you started this second half? Just so you can see that.
I can show you another movie if you want. I wanted to. but ask me, ask your question.
This is perfect. So you can see the constellations of stars, you know, that are above in the black field. Those are presumably going to become pinning sites, right?
Sorry, Karen.
Now you're distracting me with your movie. I can't ask my question.
Yeah. No, it's just, I mean, because, I mean, we are all talking about crackling noise, and I love to do that. This is a kind of vintage movie that I did quite some years ago. But you can hear, I tell you just one second, the green signal corresponds to the average velocity of this crack. And the two red, the red and the blue signals correspond to transducers that I put on the side just to record the acoustic emission. Though it was in the ultrasonic regime, but then I transfer it so that we can hear. So it was just for fun. Then I can answer your question. I'm sorry.
All right. So there are white dots in the black background that presumably are going to become pinning sites. So there's spots that are more strongly bonded when you put the two halves back together, is that correct? I'm trying to understand what those are.
Yeah, actually this is again a point that I'm not perfectly controlling. I mean, just imagine I took those two plexiglass plates and I blast them with glass beads.
Right.
Then you create a rough,
Right, no, I understand that. But I'm saying maybe you can get away not with controlling it, but characterizing it.
Well, I try to characterize them. But yeah, of course you can extract typically the size that I was talking, actually also corresponding to the morphology. I characterize the crack, I mean the surface of those two plates, before breaking and after breaking, after the sandblasting and after completely breaking, and you have a characteristic size of the patches which correspond to the one I was telling you.
Okay, so there is a correspondence.
Yeah, there is a correspondence. But still, I mean, it's not satisfying because, of course, the strength of the binding, I'm not controlling. Of course, it depends on the temperature and the cooking. This is like a cooking procedure, and I try to not to play on too many parameters and try to control it as much as possible, but yeah.
But if you watch one of these movies, can you see that the big white spots there are going to become a place where something gets, a front gets pinned?
This is not clear, honestly, and we have tried, and we are trying much more now also. I mean, looking at even smaller scale and see if we can have a process done and precursors and so on. And that's why also, that was the motivation of the acoustics. But, yeah.
You are correct. The second part is more interesting than the first part.
Ah, thanks. But the first part is an old story, but I wanted to make it clear. It was just, also Laurent asked me to make it, to make a kind of review all of those results, so well.
And for your second part, can we apply it to different temperatures or loading rate? Would that be possible?
Oh, yes, it could be, but I think we have a huge amount of data already, and okay, adding the temperature, it could be interesting. How should I say that? I did an experiment, a bit funny, because okay, before we had not so performant cameras, and when you're using those high speed and high acquisition frame rate, you had to put a lot of light. Funnily is that during one experiment, I forget, I let the light on for quite a while. And actually, my sample was melting locally. And you could see, I mean, how it was affecting the development of the front. And could be a nice experiment to perform. I tried to do that more carefully, but I didn't play with the temperature, really.
Okay, I'm being instructed that the caterers are ready to feed us, and yes. As I had said, there is a speaker missing. We're going to reconvene at 11:30, I guess is what I've been told. That means that we may be ready for lunch a little earlier. Lunch will not be ready for us, is what I was just told. The caterers have their own schedule. But we will have time to have informal discussions before the lunch.
Thank you.